Well, an Ontario court recently ruled that parents that consistently refuse to pay child support can be sent to jail. Now, the threat of jail time is intended to, and I'll quote here, induce compliance with a parent's support obligations. The concern here is that apparently not all parents that struggle with child support payments are deadbeat parents, as seems to be assumed by this legislation. In fact, many are victims of what is considered to be rigid court-enforced child support payment guidelines that don't account for the intricacies and subtleties of each individual situation. So they're looking for alternatives and simply saying, look, you can't legislate common sense, and sometimes there can be better ways than actually going to court to get these sorts of things resolved. Sheila Kirsch is a chair and founding member of the Collaborative Practice in Toronto for over 20 years now. She's been practicing family law, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about some of these problems and a possible solution. As a matter of fact, one that she's been working on for quite some time. We're pleased to welcome her to the Bill Kelly Show. Sheila, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for the time today. Listen, maybe a couple of questions about this first, just in the way of background, before we start talking a little bit about the collaborative practice that you've been working on. There's a great deal of misinformation, I think, about what happens with support payments when families separate and divorces are granted. And we know about the family law office, and that's been in place for quite some time now.
Right.
And, of course, there can be a number of different ways that the family law office can get involved with making sure that support payments are made, whether it's a garnishee of wages or any number of other things. So why, then, the threat of jail time for people that don't comply? It seems as if all the safeguards are already in place.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are things that the Family Responsibility Office can do to enforce payments. I think that, reading the case that was in the paper, we have to be careful. It's not the same as reading what the exact case says. But,
sure.
It's clear that really the court should only resort to imprisonment as a last resort. It's not something that should be taken lightly. Certainly there has to be more than just, a couple of payments that are owing. There has to be a willful and deliberate disregard for the court orders. The person has to be given an opportunity to tell their side of the story. And there are many other enforcement methods that they can use, such as suspending a driver's license or other licenses or permits or garnishing wages.
They do that in Ontario, don't they, Sheila? I
mean,
If you're behind in your payments and it's time to renew your driver's license, you don't get the license until you bring the payments up to full payment.
That's exactly right, and that's what I'm suggesting, that some of those enforcement procedures would certainly be used before somebody is going to be put into prison.
Is this a last resort, then? I mean, obviously that's the way it's being characterized right now. Does it happen, though? I mean, it seems as if there's a long list of things that have to be exhausted before you look at going to jail as a last resort here.
Absolutely. This should be used only in extreme circumstances and as a last resort. It's not something that should be used before the other enforcement procedures have been utilized.
All right, I'm going to get into an issue of fairness, or some people may consider unfairness, because one of the things that would obviously be a factor in this is the amount of the payments, especially relative to the individuals who have to make the payments. Is there not a formula that's in place, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that would determine exactly how much somebody would have to pay, or is it... you hear stories, and these are, of course, anecdotal stories from not even from the Ontario court jurisdiction, but from other places, that simply say that, sometimes court-ordered support payments even exceed what that individual makes on a monthly or an annual basis, and it's impossible to try to comply anyway.
Yeah, well, we do have the child support guidelines in place, and that's, in direct relation to what the person, what the income is. But oftentimes, it's not really clear what the income of the person is, especially if they have their own business. And in addition to that base amount, there's always extraordinary expenses that are add-ons. But I think that in the collaborative process, it's a way in which we can tailor-make the support payments to the parenting situation, and we look at the interests of the parties, and we look at what their finances are, what their income is, what the assets are, and we look at a whole package and try and tailor make the package to the interests of the parents and in the best interests of the family.
You made an interesting point there that when that process is ongoing, I mean, that's the financial picture there is really a snapshot in time, and that can change dramatically. Well, let's face it, we're in a much deeper economic crisis than we were, say, 12 months ago, And, you know, if, just as it's having an impact on our life savings and in some people's cases their jobs, it's got to have an impact on the ability to pay, too.
Absolutely, and that's what we try to build into the agreements that we make, to have a safeguard and to have basically steps to follow if things change, like someone loses their job or their income decreases. We have clauses put into place in the agreements that say, you know, they can talk to each other first. If they can't work it out, they can try some other methods like coming back to the collaborative process or mediation, so that you don't get into a situation where time passes by and arrears are accumulating to a great amount. They can deal with it at the time quickly and work it out.
Before this process was developed, and we're going to talk about that in just a couple of seconds, because I think this is a fascinating avenue that people need to explore. But before this was developed, was the old adage, okay, one side gets a lawyer, the other side gets a lawyer, and see you in court?
Yeah, basically that's the traditional model for negotiations, usually what happens in that case is the two lawyers are really dealing with each other and the clients are sort of in the background giving each lawyer instructions. But in the collaborative process, it's more of a team approach. The clients each have their own collaboratively trained lawyer, and we can have a neutral financial professional and a neutral family professional who has expertise in the emotional aspects of it and in parenting plans. And we sign a participation agreement at the beginning that we're not going to go to court, we're not going to threaten to go to court. And if for some reason it doesn't work out and one of the parties wants to litigate, they both have to get new lawyers. So there's a huge incentive and focus on settlement. And it's really amazing to see how it works. You know, we have a lot of trained professionals with lots of experience and expertise to build into the team.
You know, the thing that just struck me about this as I was reading about this, and I think this is a fascinating idea, Sheila, but it would seem to me that when a marriage is breaking down and you know, the husband is going one way, the wife going the other way, and especially if there are kids involved in this, that would seem to me the worst time to try to set up some sort of a collaborative negotiation, because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, tempers are probably, frayed. I mean, people are usually at polar opposites. It doesn't seem to be the circumstance where you could actually get both sides sitting down there to try to find common ground.
Well, you know, I'm not suggesting that, the collaborative process is for everybody. Certainly there's a place for, litigation and for courts and judges. But, you know, I would say in the majority of cases, it's a viable option for most people, trying to leave the family intact. As I said, we have, family professionals to deal with the emotional aspects of it. And in my experience, we are able to work through to the adults sort of look to their higher level and look at the best interest of the family and certainly the best interest of the children. Let's face it, you know, they only have certain resources, emotional and financial resources, and we try to put those resources to the best use we possibly can to find a win-win situation in settling the case for both parties and for them to find a way that they can continue to have a relationship with the family, albeit it's not the same as when they were together. It's different homes, but they're still going to be a family in the sense that they're still going to have children and be communicating with one another, and that's going to be ongoing, especially with children, for a long time.
Is there any sense, you mentioned the fact that a number of professionals are involved in this process, Sheila, is there any attempt at reconciliation, or is that bridge been crossed, and this is just a matter of trying to come to some sort of an agreement after the separation has already been decided upon?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I have had some experience where the parties come to me and they've decided that they want to separate, and we've started the collaborative process, and during the collaborative process and with the other professionals involved, they actually have reconciled. So, I mean, it does happen. It's certainly not the norm, but it can happen.
Well, I suppose if you get people into the room. Physically, describe to me, Sheila, what happens. Now, you say, for instance, that both spouses would hire a collaborative lawyer, somebody who's trained to be able to do this.
Right, that's right. Well, we have a website. My firm website is kirsch-law.com, and the Collaborative Practice Toronto website is collaborativepracticetoronto.com. They can go to that website. There's very good information on the website. It talks about the participation agreement. It talks about all the members who are trained in the collaborative process. That means the lawyers.
Yeah, who would you bring in? Who would be on your team, for instance?
Well, there's always two lawyers, but they could also be a family professional if, you know, if parenting is an issue, and we can bring in a parenting person who's a family professional who has expertise in doing parenting plans, and that person is a neutral. So there's one person who sort of works out the parenting part of it. We can bring in a financial professional, somebody who's also a neutral, who can actually, you know, do forecasts of income and assets and so on. And that's very helpful. We work as a team to try to, as I said, find the best solution, prioritizing the interests of this particular couple. So in other words, it's a custom-made settlement. It's sort of not a cookie-cutter settlement. I'll give you a short example. Let's say you have an orange to split up. The court might just say, well, why not just cut that orange in half and each party gets one half of the orange? But in the collaborative process, we would say to one party, you know, what is there about the orange that particularly interests you? And one person might say, well, I like the pulp. I like to eat the pulp. And the other person might say, well, I like the rind because I like baking and it's very good in pies and so on. So instead of just cutting the orange in half, we might give one person all of the pulp and the other person all of the rind.
It's an interesting concept. Boy, I wish if oranges were the only thing that was being developed, life would be a lot easier. Listen, I got to do a short break. Stick around for you because I'll walk through this process just a little bit too because I want people to get as much information on this as they possibly can. Our guest is Sheila Kerr. She's the chair and founding member of Collaborative Practice in Toronto. It's a different way to try to develop strategies for child support payments and making sure those payments are done, I suppose, too, has to be part of this process too. As opposed to see you in court, and that can get expensive and sometimes rather adversarial, too. Back with more in just a couple of seconds. This is The Bill Kelly Show on CHML and Cable 14. This is The Bill Kelly Show. You're listening on AM 900, CHML. You're watching on Cable 14. Our guest is Sheila Kerr. She is the chair and founding member of Collaborative Practices in Toronto. We're just talking about the alternative to, well, what can be very costly and time consuming litigation, I guess, in separation cases and divorce cases, and of course, support payments too. And Sheila, we've only got a few minutes left, and I kind of wanted to walk through the process. If I walked through the door and said, okay, listen, I'm interested in this, what would you counsel? In other words, what do I need to bring to the table so you can do your job?
Well, the first thing that would happen is I would walk you through the processes that are available to you. If you chose the collaborative process, then we would the other party would have to also hire a collaboratively trained lawyer. We would arrange the first four-way or six-way or five-way meeting, depending on who the other members of the teams are, and we would sign the participation agreement, as I said, agreeing not to go to court or to threaten to go to court.
That's going to be a big hurdle.
No,
because you figure a lot of people would like to have that in their back pocket just in case.
Well, people get the participation agreement by email in advance, so they know exactly what to expect. And we have some participation agreements on the website, so they have an idea of what they're going to be signing. And certainly the lawyer at the first interview would have gone over it and explained the different clauses. So that's really not a big hurdle. After that, we collect the financial information so that we have financial disclosure. And then we generate options, and we talk about what the consequences of those options are. And then we try to come to a settlement that's best suited for this particular family.
Now, here are a couple of questions about that. First and foremost, how difficult is it to get both parties, both spouses, to agree to this kind of process? It seems as if there's any kind of an adversarial relationship that they might be a little bit wary about getting into something like this.
Well, that's true. I mean, there always is a problem if one of the parties doesn't want this process and would rather go to litigation. But I refer them to our website, which is collaborativepracticetoronto.com, or my website, which is kirsch-law.com. There's a lot of information on there. And I think when they read about, you know, that it's a respectful way of resolving disputes in a private setting and to come up with a solution that is ongoing and will stand the test of time. And we build into the agreement ways that they can deal with changes that occur so that they don't have to, you know, come back to the collaborative process necessarily unless they have some problems. We try to teach them better communication skills. We try to model good communication skills during the process so that it enables them at a time later on when they do have some other changes in their lives that they can work it out themselves.
Now, I don't want to create the impression, and I don't think this is the case, where, I mean, everybody at the end of this, you know, just, you know, joins hands around the table and, you know, we sing Kumbaya. It's got to be a tough process no matter what. And you mentioned, for instance, about the financial disclosure.
Right.
And now, when I've talked to lawyers that have been involved in this on this program, time and time again, they'll tell me that's usually the biggest nut to crack, because as soon as you know, one spouse looks at the financial records of the other and says, well, that's not true. No, that's not. Oh, they're hiding money or this or that. And that seems to be the most contentious element. Do you find that to be the case?
Well, it can be the case, except in a collaborative process, we agree at the outset that we're going to have financial disclosure. It's going to be complete financial disclosure. So that's why we can have a neutral financial person who can help both of them come to the table and show what their assets and liabilities and financial situation is. So if people are intent on hiding assets and, you know, having bank accounts and offshore accounts, well, then this certainly isn't the process for them, because that's not what this is all about. This is a complete disclosure from the start.
Have you ever had a situation, I'm just hypothesizing here, where your financial individual look at somebody's records and say, like, I'm sorry, this just doesn't jive, you're not being honest with us here?
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then we certainly have the ways to, you know, ask them about it and to give them the opportunity to disclose what the financial assets are. And if they're trying to deceive us, then certainly this is not the process for them. That's not the type of people who are going to, you know, want to come to the collaborative process. You know, the people who want here to come to this process are sincere and want to resolve their situation in a way that, financially and emotionally they can afford to do so, and come out with an agreement at the end that they can live with and that will last and will provide for changes as their life goes on.
Now, does this deal really just kind of cover child support payments, or is spousal support included in this too?
No, we look at the whole package. We look at spousal support, we look at division of assets, we look at custody and access and residency and spousal support. We look at the whole package, and that's what we try to put together, is a whole package. And that's why we can sort of tailor make it, because different people have different interests and priorities of interest. So we do try to find a way that will satisfy both of them and become sort of a win-win situation for them.
Well,
obviously, not everybody can get everything that they want, but we do try to prioritize and tailor make it to suit them.
Exactly. Listen, I've heard so much about this over the last couple of months. I'm really glad you had the opportunity to talk to us about this today. I got about 10 seconds left here. If they want to get some more information, your website is
kirsch-law.com or collaborativepracticetoronto.com.
Sheila, thanks so much for this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. Sheila Kirsch with a bit of a different perspective, I guess, in trying to come up with some sort of settlement like that of what can be an ugly process and an ugly time. Hey, we're out of time.